Good morning. My name's Susan. I'm not yet 40:10, but I do need these to read the Bible. So if you'd like to join with me, you can. Today's Bible reading is from Daniel chapter 4, beginning at verse 10. It can be found on page 616 of the Red Bibles in the pews, or will also be up on the screen to my right. And just to put this passage in context, it starts off with Nebuchadnezzar speaking, and Belteshazzar is also known, it's another name for Daniel. So Daniel chapter 4, beginning at verse 10. These are the visions I saw while lying in bed. I looked, and there before me stood a tree in the middle of the land. Its height was enormous. The tree grew large and strong, and its top touched the sky. It was visible to the ends of the earth. Its leaves were beautiful, its fruit abundant, and on it was food for all. Under it, the wild animals found shelter, and the birds lived in its branches. From it, every creature was fed. In the visions I saw while lying in bed, I looked, and there before me was a holy one, a messenger coming down from heaven. He called in a loud voice, "Cut down the tree and trim off its branches. Strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But let the stump and its roots, bound with iron and bronze, remain in the ground, in the grass of the field. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him live with the animals among the plants of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let him be given the mind of an animal, till seven times pass by for him. The decision is announced by messengers. The holy ones declare the verdict, so that the living may know that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes and sets over them the lowliest of people. This is the dream that I, King Nebuchadnezzar, had. Now, Belteshazzar, tell me what it means, for none of the wise men in my kingdom can interpret it for me. But you can, because the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Then Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, was greatly perplexed for a time, and his thoughts terrified him. So the king said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you. Belteshazzar answered, My lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. The tree you saw, which grew large and strong, with its top touching the sky, visible to the whole earth, with beautiful leaves and abundant fruit, providing food for all, giving shelter to the wild animals, and having nesting places in its branches for the birds? Your Majesty, you are that tree. You have become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion extends to distant parts of the earth. Your Majesty saw a holy one, a messenger coming down from heaven and saying, Cut down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump, bound with iron and bronze, in the grass of the field, while its roots remain in the ground. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him live with the wild animals until seven times pass by for him. This is the interpretation, Your Majesty, and this is the decree the Most High has issued against my lord the king. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox and be drenched with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. Therefore, Your Majesty, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that then your prosperity will continue. All this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" Even as the words were on his lips, a voice came from heaven. "This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken away from you. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox. 7 times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes." Immediately what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people and ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nail like the claws of a bird. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time that my sanity was restored, my honor and splendor were returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne and became even greater than before. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble.
Well, hi, my name's Tom. If I haven't met you before, I'd love to do that after the service. For the next 25 minutes or so, my job is to try and help that passage to land in our lives in 2024. And so to get that started, it's worth noting that what we're talking about today is the stuff of history. Sometimes people, when they approach the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, they think, oh, these are stories that have been constructed to teach us a lesson. And while they do actually help us to live our lives well, there's a lot more going on than just that. The main guy in today's passage is Nebuchadnezzar. If you go to the British Museum, you'll be able to see artifacts a little bit like this one. If you jump across the channel and you go to Berlin, you go to the Pergamon Museum, you might be able to see the Ishtar Gate, some of which I think was just literally transplanted and some of which they've reconstructed. And on one of the inner panels, you'll be able to see that they've written King Nebuchadnezzar, King of Babylon, the pious prince appointed by the will of Marduk. All I'm trying to say today is that we are reading the stuff of history. And historically, this guy, one of the most powerful people in the world at that time, has a dream, which is not history, but then it does come true. So we're back in the land of history. Now, the Bible reading was done for us so well that I'll just give you a very short recap of the story, and I'll spend most of my time unpacking why it actually matters for us. But short recap of the story is that he has a dream, and in that dream, he is pictured as a giant tree. And underneath that tree, all of the other animals and birds, they find their existence. Daniel comes along to interpret that dream for him, and he says, "Wish it wasn't this way, but you're the tree. And you are going to be cut down. All of the other animals they represented, like the other kingdoms that exist under your reign, and you will be cut down." The passage does seem to go to great lengths to point out that the tree was not entirely uprooted, but there was a little bit of a stump left. There's always a possibility of restoration, renewal, and repentance. Now, all of this comes true. We're in the verses of 29 and 30 at this point. He's standing on top of his palace. He's looking out over, for example, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. He's built some pretty impressive stuff. He big notes himself, and in that moment, God drags him down. He's reduced to this kind of beastly state. But from there, after repenting, apparently the account ends that he's raised back up and restored to potentially even greater fame and fortune than he was before. Notice the V shape in what's happening here. He starts high, he goes low, he ends up potentially even higher. And you probably meant to save this bit right for the end, but this is a very similar life trajectory to that of Jesus, right? Jesus starts high, and Nebuchadnezzar was humbled not by his own will, but Jesus actually intentionally humbles himself, comes into the earth, leaves heaven, enters earth, goes down to the kind of the worst experience of earth that you could have. He goes to the cross itself, goes to death. But from there, he's raised up, and now Ephesians 1:10, God is uniting all things under him. So there's a similarity there between Nebuchadnezzar's trajectory down and up in the same way that there is for us. And so with all of that as introduction, I wanted to spend most of our time today talking about why this matters for us. And I think the main theme that is going to be helpful for us today is to talk about pride. It is possible to talk about this passage through the lens of power, and particularly if you tune into verse 17, 25, and 32, it says almost the same thing three times in a row about acknowledging that God is the power over all other powers. But today I just want to particularly tune into the lens of pride. Dorothy Sayers defined pride in this way: I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Notice here the inward turn that pride takes. It's all about I. It's all about me. It's all about my. There's an inward turn that happens when we engage in pride. One time, actually, someone walked up to Jesus and they said, "Hey, Jesus, a lot of things are written in the Old Testament. Can you give me the shortcut? What is the greatest commandment?" Jesus said, "Well, there's kind of two. Love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself." Notice that Jesus is not talking about an inward turn. He's talking about the direct opposite. He's saying that when humanity is functioning at its finest, the way that we are meant to be living our fully human lives would be looking upwards to God, looking outwards to our neighbor, and the only thing that we talk about looking inwards is as the yardstick for how we're meant to look outwards. We love our neighbor as ourselves. Nobody has a problem loving themselves. We always look after ourselves. That's the yardstick for how we're meant to love our neighbor. See, this is all the opposite of pride. When humans are functioning well, they look outwards and upwards. When humans are functioning deeply problematically, we look inwards. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. As we come to the passage, I am fascinated by the overlap between what Dorothy Sayers said and what King Nebuchadnezzar is recorded as saying in verses 29 and 30. It'll come up on the screen if you've got a physical Bible in front of you, follow along too. 12 months later, so God gives a 12-month gap between the original dream and the warning. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power for the glory of my majesty?" Can you see the inward turn in Nebuchadnezzar? Fascinatingly here, Nebuchadnezzar is actually worthy of some of these descriptors. He has done some pretty phenomenal military conquering. He has built some pretty phenomenal things. He is a big deal ruler at the time. And so if you and I said this, it would just be deluded. He's not actually deluded, but what he has done is he's taken that inward turn. Notice as well about pride as we come to verse 33. The result here is that pride is not only firstly an inward turn, but secondly, it's the opposite of community. I won't labor this point for too long, but post-COVID, isn't it true to say that we all are talking a lot about community? Everyone wants community. Ironically, we want community that's more like a gym than a sports team, don't we? We want community where I can show up whenever I feel like it and the community will just be active. I can participate in it for a bit and then leave whenever I feel like it. But we do realize eventually that community only happens when it's more like a sports team, right? I show up at the time that I'm supposed to be there because we've all agreed to be there at the same time. We all want community, and yet one of the things you can notice from this passage is that pride does the opposite of dragging us together. Nebuchadnezzar, was driven away from the people. And as we think about church as a community here, it's worth noting that pride is actually one of the things that can break us as a community and just turn us into a community of, you know, people who sit side by side on a Sunday and then leave. But the calling is so much greater. Let's look at the third thing, and this is probably the most special contribution of this passage to the theme of pride throughout the whole Bible. And the third idea here is this, that pride is deeply dehumanizing. Pride makes us like an animal. See, in the passage, we see what happens to Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven away from people and ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. This is a picture of Nebuchadnezzar. It's not, obviously not a real picture, but this is an artist interpretation. You can find it in a gallery in Boston of Nebuchadnezzar. I like that they've drawn out the idea that his hair has grown long. They've drawn out the idea that his nails are like the claws of a bird. They've drawn a beastly figure. If you go into Old Testament or even if you go into lots of ancient texts beyond the Bible, how do you make a beastly figure? You get the human and you get the animal and you mash them together. This is exactly what's happened to Nebuchadnezzar. There's nothing beastly about a bird, but there's something beastly about a bird that's mixed with a human. His sin dehumanizes him. If I could take you deeper into that point, this is the bit to tune into that needs a little bit more concentration. A Bible commentator called Ernest C. Lucas said it better than I could. Follow along here. Pride is not satisfied with being a little lower than God, Psalm 8, and reaches for the heavens, so blurring the human-divine distinction. When we reject our creaturely status and seek to become God, we are in danger of becoming subhuman. Put that in other words for you. When you read Genesis, there's a three-part hierarchy that you can pick up, right? God's at the top, he made everything, and then there's all of his creatures. We're one of his creatures, but we're set above his other creatures. We're supposed to have dominion and rule. Pete, could I grab some water, man? Is that all right? Thank you so much. So there's this three-part hierarchy going on. As you come to Psalm 8 that the commentator is pointing out, Psalm 8 says that humans were made a little lower than the angels. So you get like a fourth part of the hierarchy. You get God, big jump down to the angels. We're supposed to be a little lower than the angels, but still above the animals. What do we see from Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar tries to drag himself up, and God says, I'm going to drag you down. He tries to assert himself as something higher than human, angelic, godly, and he also is dragged down into the beastly by God. Thank you so much, Pete. Appreciate it. And so I want to say today that sin dehumanizes us. It is the opposite of what it means to be a true human. If we come back to the dream for just a second as we push forward in the account, the dream is that there's a massive tree, all of the animals and the kingdoms find their being underneath it. And as we move forward, we realize that the stump itself remains. Now, in our culture today, we're not huge on the idea of restoration. We're particularly keen on the idea of justice. And I think that's good and right that we've rediscovered our need for justice. Can I just say that from a biblical perspective, there has to be some place for the idea of renewal and restoration in your understanding of human relationships. God seems to be a God of renewal and restoration as well as of justice. And right here, what we see on display is the renewal and the restoration. In Christian terms, we might say the repentance of Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 34, it's up on the screen. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven. He is in his beastly state, and from there, he does the most human thing you can do, which is to look upwards. Love the Lord your God with all your heart. He changes from his beastly moment, and he does actually the opposite of what he did before. If we go back to that V-shape idea, he's standing on his palace, he's looking in, and he's also looking out and down, isn't he? Down is exactly where God takes him. But when he's at the absolute bottom in his beastly state, he chooses to look up, and that's exactly where God takes him. He does the most human thing that you could. As we move all the way to verse 37, this is the end of the account. Notice two things. Now, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven because everything he does is right. All his ways are just. We are going to sing in about 10 minutes' time. When we sing, we're doing a little bit like this first sentence. As you read through the passage, if you took the lens of power and you focus on verses 17, 25, 32, a lot of the emphasis is on simply acknowledging the way things are. God wants people in this passage to acknowledge that he is above every other ruler, every other power. When we stand to sing together, for example, we're doing the same thing. We're acknowledging the way things really are. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar gets to at the end of his journey, is he is able to acknowledge things the right way around, where he says that I praise, exalt, and glorify the King of heaven. Now, I have a problem with the passage. This is the second thing I'd love for you to notice about that last sentence. Problem with the passage is that last sentence. Those who walk in pride, he's able to humble. Do you see the problem? As you reflect on proud people you know and proud people maybe through human history, the proud, he is able to humble. Does that just mean that he's able to do it? Or does it mean that everyone who's proud will eventually be humbled? Deep down, we want everyone who's proud to one day be humbled, right? We want to think about the rulers who have done great atrocities, and yet they seem to have just kind of died in their sleep or had a pleasant ending. We want justice there, don't we? Nebuchadnezzar, he actually faces the consequences of his own action in his life. He is humbled in very earthly terms. But isn't it true to say that there are many many proud people throughout the world? Maybe you think about global rulers. Maybe you just think about people closer to home for you. And you say, that person just was proud their whole life. And they never had a Nebuchadnezzar moment. They never got lowered. And so is this verse really true, or does it just mean God is able to do it? It's just that he doesn't often. As we skip forward to Proverbs chapter 16, for example, it says the same thing. It says, pride goes before destruction. And everyone says, ah, man, we hate those proud people. Problem is that if there is no God, if there is no final judgment day, then that's not necessarily true, is it? If we're relying on human courts or human judgment systems to bring the proud down, then actually we better make our justice system so much better than they are, because they don't always bring all the proud to justice, do they? This is that strange moment where judgment day for a Christian actually becomes a comfort. Can I say that again? When judgment day actually becomes a comfort, because we recognize that is the moment that the proud really will be brought down. It's what we all want. And yet, if you live in a worldview where you just live, you die, that's it, then it is very possible that the proud never get humbled. Can I draw us towards a conclusion? I've got two relatively substantial points to make, and this is where it might connect a little bit closer to your own experience. First thing is that I have had the burden this week of preparing a sermon on pride, which means I've been thinking about pride for a whole week or so. And every now and then, my mind goes to, I wonder if I'm proud. Nah, let's just go back to preparing the sermon. No, and as you sit there and you reflect on your own pride, I wonder if you come with me on this journey, you realize that I am more proud than I realized. If you just sit there and recognize it for a minute, you are more proud than you realized. You see this in at least two ways. You see this when things go well in your life, you see this when things go badly in your life. Nebuchadnezzar, he's on the going well team. Things are going well, his kingdom is conquering other kingdoms, he's building infrastructure, he's having a good time. In verse 4, it says that I was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. That is a dangerous place for a believer to be. Contented and prosperous, because when we are contented and prosperous, isn't it true to say that our pride can come out, our inward turn can happen? And we're building little mini kingdoms, nothing like his kingdom. But the same thing happens in our heart, isn't it? We're contented, we're prosperous. If things are going well in your life today, I'm really glad for you. And I would just wave the warning flag and say that Jesus often taught us to beware. He said, he talked about the fool who said, hey, everything's going really well, built a big barn, put all my stuff in the barn, and now I can just sit back, things will go well. And Jesus says, you fool, tonight your life will be required of you. That riches, that gain, that progress, that success can be deeply spiritually problematic. You see it in Nebuchadnezzar, and I think you see it in our own hearts as well. You see that we are more proud than we realized when things go well. We also see that we're more proud than we realized when things go badly. If I could touch on two examples to make this clear for us. First one is some of us in the room are aware of what it feels like to lose a job. Some of us in the room are aware of what it feels like to lose a partner, to lose a relationship that you really valued. And in that moment, our wounded pride speaks. And you say, you don't realize how much I contribute around here. You don't realize how sad you're going to be without me. And the same inward turn comes out, not only when things go well, but when things go badly. It's just a universal part of the human condition that our pride seems to be stoked by all manner of things. I want to try and push with you today the idea that I am more proud than we might have realized 25 minutes ago. And that ought to be deeply concerning. James chapter 4, for example. God opposes Tom. If you identify as someone who's being in a state of pride, God opposes the proud, but he shows favor to the humble. We should be deeply disquieted by the own pride inside of us. And I'll finish with this. We are actually equipped for a special humility. You can stand up here. I'm saying to somebody earlier today that this is the easiest sermon in the world to preach, right? You stand up, you talk to a bunch of people in church and you say, pride is bad. And everyone says, yeah, it's true. Okay, good sermon. What I want to push with you today as we finish is that you are equipped for more than just an Australian version of humility. You know, like Australian culture, if you contrast it maybe with American culture, Americans are quite good at big noting themselves and saying, look at me, I am really great at all these things. As Australians, if you swim in the same cultural water that I do, you recoil against that and you say, oh, the aim of the game is actually to be the most self-effacing, to put yourself down the most. That's like Australian humility. Can I show you Christian humility at a whole nother level? Think about pride and what it is for just a second. I remember walking through a train station in China something like 7-8 years ago. If you've walked through Central, Town Hall, Wynyard anytime soon, picture one of those stations and then like quadruple the amount of people trying to go through those passageways. You've got the idea. And what I've noticed when you're walking through a city train station is that people at least try to dodge each other as they're walking around. In this particular train station, there were just so many people that was impossible. Everyone was straight lining and just shoulders like. And I'm thinking, this really hurts my sense of pride to go in this train station because there's like 1,000 people here. I'm just one of them. And then I thought about the country I was in at the time, and I'm like, hey, there's apparently approximately 1 billion people in this country. Imagine being one of 1 billion. And then I thought, oh, there's something like 7 billion people on earth. I actually am one of 7 billion people. And something inside of me cries out against being such a small number in such a big world. And it makes me want to assert myself to say, please notice me. Please know me. Please love me. Please respect me. Please at least know my name. Know something about me. I don't just want to be one out of 7 billion. And in that moment, I say, well, how can I be known? How can I be loved? See, if you're a Christian, you are resourced in a way that nobody else is, to not need to do whatever your culture's appropriate way of asserting yourself is, because God's your dad. You say, I want to be loved. I say, yeah, God is your father. You're his daughter and he loves you. You're his son and he's so proud of you. Doesn't that free you from needing to be like everybody else, asserting yourself? God knows how many hairs are on your head. He was with you at 6:17 a.m. He knows you so deeply. Doesn't that free you from needing to only be limited to an Australian version of humility and actually being able to take on a Christian version of humility where you say, I am loved and known. I don't need to assert myself. And we are free to be the most humble people if we'll lean in that direction. You want to pray with me? Band, you guys can come up. God, as we're about to sing to you now, we ask that you just give us a great joy in acknowledging things the way they truly are, that you are the most sovereign over everyone, that we are just your people. We are in the position that you made us, and we embrace that, and we joyfully accept that. We thank you so much that you make it possible for us to not have our lives dominated by the need for self-assertion. That we thank you so much that there is a coming judgment day and the proud really will face their actions. We ask that you'd help us to embrace humility now, to embrace humility by coming to you, and to embrace humility in our lives going forward. Everyone who agreed said,